Thanks, Roger Mark. I'm never sure if it's good to be the last one on a panel because your colleagues can quite often make all the points that you intend to make along the way. I was thinking a lot, especially during Dan's discussion about the state of affairs and globally, especially in the Sustainable Development Goals, some hope for optimism over what was achieved in the Millennium Development Goals that preceded them. Overall, hunger globally has gone down from over a billion people to 795 billion people chronically undernourished now. Conflicts have reduced in the last few years from 63 in 2008 to 2014. But underneath that optimistic progress we've made, some really worrying trends are going on. Humanitarian needs have gone up by almost fivefold in the last 10 years, from $3.4 billion globally in 2006 to $20 billion last year. And at the start of this year, global humanitarian needs are $22.5 billion, estimated by OCHA, with 128 million people in need of humanitarian assistance this year, 70 million in need of food assistance, as Dan mentioned, that FuseNet put out yesterday. At the same time, conflicts have become more intense. Those 63 conflicts in 2008 were responsible for an estimated 56,000 fatalities. In 2014, that was 180,000. So less conflicts, but much more intense and much more protracted humanitarian crises. The average period of displacement is now 17 years in the world. I think everyone's mentioned innovation on the panel, and those the statistics I just give you, I think, provide a really strong rationale for why there's so much innovation at the moment. Amongst all of us working on long-term food security and on humanitarian response to crises around the world, because we have no choice. As Dan said, there was a 50% gap in humanitarian funding last year. Last year, there was more humanitarian funding than there has ever been before, more than ever, but there's never been a bigger gap in humanitarian funding. And 2017 looks like it's going to be even worse. So we're all innovating out of necessity. And there's lots of interesting things going on. So first, maybe I'll just touch on kind of three concrete areas where we're seeing innovation. But then I'd also like to make a point about innovation in general to conclude. First, Dan said, quite clearly that even though we had good early warning for Somalia, there was a failure of response. And that's not the only case. There's been a huge improvement in the quality of early warning over the last 10 or 15 years. Most major food crises especially have been predicted with six or more months of notice since then. Yet in most cases, there hasn't been an adequate early response. We get an early warning. We wait for an agricultural season to fail. We assess the situation. We do the same kind of things that we did before. And that's caused a number of us to realize that what we need is much more predictability of response and predictability of funding for response, and to be able to establish systems that are going to respond almost without human intervention. In other words, we decide we're going to respond beforehand, and then if something happens, we do it instead of discussing it. And there's a lot of work going on around trying to turn that early warning, early action idea into practice. So the first kind of innovation area that I want to touch on is in risk financing. There's a tremendous amount of work and some really good examples of institutions and countries putting in place mechanisms to ensure that money is on the table when it's needed. For example, in Ethiopia, for their productive safety net, there's a risk financing mechanism which includes both a contingency budget and a $250 million contingent finance fund, which is triggered based on agroclimatic early warning data. The African Union has established the African Risk Capacity, which is an index-based drought insurance mechanism where countries can pay insurance premiums to cover them against drought. And that's now operating in seven countries and has paid out in a number of them right at the end of the agricultural season based on agroclimatic drought triggers. Humanitarian agencies are going further and using climate forecasts to trigger financing before a potential disaster strikes, using something called forecast-based financing. The Red Cross, the START Network, which is a network of UK NGOs, and the World Food Programme are all putting in place this kind of mechanism. One of the interesting things about forecast-based financing is forecasts are not always right. In other words, our climate friends will tell us there's a 60% chance of a drought occurring in a place. That means there's a 40% chance the drought won't occur. And so if you decide to take action at that point, there's a chance that your action might be in vain, that nothing might happen and you didn't need to respond. Although given that 80% of the world's food insecure people live in highly degraded environments and rely on rain-fed agriculture for their livelihoods, even a small climate shock can quickly translate into a disaster. But there's an increasing willingness among the humanitarian community to take the risk of taking action before something happens to reduce its potential impact, even if they get it wrong. And there's some strong economics behind that. DFID did a study called the Economics of Early Response and Resilience, where they calculated that if we had responded immediately after droughts in Kenya over the last 20 years, instead of waiting 6 to 9 months to trigger a response, which has been the typical situation in Kenya, we would have saved $20 billion, $1 billion a year, and we could have mounted 4 full-scale emergency responses to drought before we started losing money. In other words, responding to drought when there wasn't one, it would have taken us 4 responses to start losing money. So we know that you can save enough money by anticipating a problem to justify acting in vain at times. And that's pretty exciting because that means that you can help farmers switch from their normal seed varieties to drought-tolerant varieties or improve on-farm drought management practices. Or you can trigger blanket supplementary feeding programs for kids in an area that traditionally face high rates of acute malnutrition during drought before the drought occurs so that they can be in better health and nutritional status to deal with that stress when it comes. Ultimately helping them weather the shock, but also saving significant costs later on down the road because the kinds of things that you would need to do if you didn't take that preventative action are often much more expensive. So there's a lot of really exciting work going on in risk financing to try and get ahead of that curve and be more predictable. The second area is, you know, we see often the most visible crises, but those crises are happening in places that have recurrent lower level food crises and stress, and we only see them when they become acute, when there's a particularly difficult shock. And that's something that's been recognized for a long time, and there's been a huge investment, particularly in Africa and Asia, in improving the scope and quality of social protection systems that provide transfers To the most vulnerable, but also are used to do things like large-scale landscape transformation. And Ellen touched on a number of really important points, particularly trying to layer different kinds of interventions to get a better, more complex problem solved. And you're seeing a lot of innovation around social protection systems where, on a large scale, governments and development organizations are trying to build in both work to reduce the level of risk through things like large-scale watershed management or soil and water conservation, or, for example, better marine ecosystem conservation with those people, but then also bringing in value chains and markets and insurance and other things. And the those things are often complicated and difficult to do, but the impact evaluation results that we see are really promising. For example, in a program implemented by the World Food Program and Oxfam called the R4 Rural Resilience Initiative, they allow poor farmers working on soil and water conservation as part of their country's safety net program to work extra days on infrastructure that helps reduce drought and flood risks in exchange for an insurance policy which pays them out during a drought and improves their access to microcredit. After 4 or 5 years of doing this, the impact evaluations showed that farmers who were participating in this more integrated program had 123% more savings, 254% more household cereal stocks, 25% more plow oxen. They invested 25% more in agricultural labor. And when there were droughts and payouts, they kept their kids in school rather than pulling them out to work on their farm. And they invested in better seeds and inputs for their crop the next year. In a totally different context in the Philippines, an integrated approach to building local capacities in fisheries management, local marine ecosystems management, and better information sharing with local fisher folks improved incomes by 77%. So you're seeing significant development outcomes coming through the integration of resilience approaches and social protection. The third area that I think is really important, and it speaks a bit to the context-specific challenges that Alex and Ellen brought up, is and there's so much happening with the data revolution and mobile technology, but getting the right information to people so they can make better risk management decisions themselves is really critical. There are clearly not enough resources to deal with all of the problems that we see, and only by really empowering people to manage their own risk are we going to address all of these problems. One example from Ethiopia is Project Concern International and Google and the USA Development Lab have been developing a program called SAPARM, which takes pasture maps from satellite remote sensing that come from the Ethiopian government's national early warning system, and they map them on top of local grazing areas for pastoralists in pastoral areas of Ethiopia and Tanzania. Those maps are then printed out for just the cost of the paper. The early warning system exists, that's being paid for and maintained and operated. The mapping process is a fairly straightforward thing. And then every 10 days, these maps get printed out and given to pastoralists who use them to make decisions about where they'll send scouts to check out the pasture conditions if they have cows and camels. They're a bit finicky about what they eat, so you got to make sure that the pasture is tasty for them. Or if they have sheep and goats, they just send them. And in the first year of using those maps, livestock mortality along trekking routes dropped by 40% for those pastoralists. it costs 17 times more to replace a cow in Ethiopia than it does to prevent its death. So simple things like getting the right information to people so they can make better decisions about how to manage the risks they face have a tremendous potential to really help in these circumstances. I'll stop there, Roger Mark, and hopefully we can get into a good discussion.
Thank you.